I read again the last paragraph which I read last time. The sadhaka of the integral yoga will make use of all these aids according to his nature. But it is necessary that he should shun their limitations and cast from himself that exclusive tendency of egoistic mind which cries, my God, my incarnation, my prophet, my guru, and opposes it to all other realization in a sectarian or a fanatical spirit. All sectarianism, all fanaticism must be shunned, for it is inconsistent with the integrity of the divine realization. Now, the first sentence of this paragraph, the sadhaka of the integral yoga will make use of all these aids according to his nature. These aids, what are these aids? All these aids, which are these aids? Sri Aurobindo has said that divine himself is a teacher. But human nature being what it is, with the limitations of human nature, we may conceive of many others, such as, first, Ishta Devata. I don't know if you understand the word Ishta Devata. No, you should have asked me, no? Ishta is favorite. Devata is God. Favorite God. Some people believe Ganapati to be Ishta Devata. Some others may consider Shiva as Ishta Devata. Some consider Vishnu as Ishta Devata. Some consider Rudra as Ishta Devata. Some conceive of Durga as Ishta Devata. According to our own nature, one or the other becomes our favorite. Favorite is one in whose image we would like to be molded. That's the real meaning of favorite. You would like to be like him or like her. If I'm a worshipper of Durga, I like to be like Durga. If I'm the worshipper of Shiva, I would like to be like Shiva. When you admire, you like to become. Admiration, adoration, these are the first steps. But you become satisfied when you become like what you admire. That is Ishta Devata. So, you may consider Ishta Devata as your guru, as your teacher. Or you may like an incarnation to be your guru. Either Christ as guru, or Buddha as guru, or Krishna as guru, Rama as guru. Several incarnations. Or you may like a prophet as your guru. There is a difference between incarnation and a prophet. Incarnation is the one in whom the divine himself descends. A prophet is a very great man who has contact with the divine, but in whom divine himself has not descended. Like Muhammad is a prophet. So you may like to have Ishta Devata as your teacher, or you may like an incarnation to be your teacher, or you may like a prophet to be your teacher, or you may like a human being as your teacher. These are all the aids. So, the sadhaka of the integral yoga will make use of all these aids according to his nature. But it is necessary that he should shun their limitations and cast from himself that exclusive tendency of egoistic mind which cries, "My God, my incarnation, my prophet, my..." opposes it to all other realization in a sectarian or a fanatical spirit. All sectarianism, all fanaticism must be shunned, for it is inconsistent with the integrity of the divine realization. On the contrary, that is to say, instead of exclusivity, you have inclusivity. On the contrary, the sadhaka of the integral yoga will not be satisfied unless he has included all other names and forms of deity in his own conception, seen his own Ishta Devata in all others, unified all avatars in the unity of him who descends in the avatar, welded the truth in all teachings into the harmony of the eternal wisdom. Nor should he forget the aim of these external aids, which is to awaken his soul to the divine within him. Nothing has been finally accomplished if that has not been accomplished. It is not sufficient to worship Krishna, Christ or Buddha without, if there is not the revealing and the formation of the Buddha, the Christ or Krishna in ourselves. And all other aids equally have no other purpose. Each is a bridge between man's unconverted state and the revelation of the divine within him. So we have now a full description of our teacher. First, that the divine himself is our teacher. Secondly, that he has no method and every method, and that his system varies according to each one's nature. Third, that he is a teacher who teaches by suggestion and not by imposition. He teaches by his own example, and he teaches by his influence. Influence that proceeds from the closeness of his being with our own being. And that his entire aim is to take you through vicissitudes of experiences, varieties of experiences, so that you may awake, which is the central thing, awakening. The divine teacher awakes to his presence, to his working in the world, his hand in everything that happens to you, whether success or failure, stumbling or fall or catastrophe or a glory. Unveiling of the divine in him, in you, is what the divine ultimately aims and accomplishes. But since it is difficult for the divine teacher or for the human being to open directly to the divine teacher, there are other aids, Ishta Devata, incarnation, prophet, or a human teacher. In any case, the important thing is that the teacher must awaken, and that awakening is to the integral divine, who is not limited to one form or the other form, one Ishta Devata or another, but includes all, so that once again we can say my teacher is the Supreme Lord, who is the teacher of all. Now is the description of the human teacher, because that is easier for human beings to obtain rather than to obtain the Supreme Teacher himself directly. The teacher of the integral yoga will follow, as far as he may, the method of the teacher within us. He will lead the disciple through the nature of the disciple. This is the ultimate justification of what we call free progress system. He will lead the disciple through the nature of the disciple. Since everyone has a different nature, the system or the method will be such as to be suitable to each one, to his own nature. Even when there is a collective class like this, he looks upon each one differently, and he addresses in such a way that each one can derive, according to his own nature, what is suitable to him or to her. He will lead the disciple through the nature of the disciple. Teaching, example, influence, these are the three instruments of the guru. But the wise teacher will not seek to impose himself or his opinions on the passive acceptance of the receptive mind. He doesn't become a propagandist. A good teacher is not a propagandist. He does not make any propaganda. He does not want that his opinions should be accepted by his pupils. He will throw in only what is productive and sure as a seed, which will grow under the divine fostering within. It's a very important statement, we shall read again. He will throw in only what is productive and sure as a seed, which will grow under the divine fostering within. The task of the teacher is only to throw a few seeds in the soil of the child, and then it is the divine who will foster. It is the divine himself who will water, put a spring of water in the seed so that the seed will grow and become a tree. He will throw in only what is productive and sure as a seed, which will grow under the divine fostering within. He will seek to awaken much more than to instruct. This is the mark of a good teacher. He doesn't like to instruct. He doesn't like to say, do this, do that, do that. He might do it, but much more important for him is to awaken. He will aim at the growth of the faculties and the experiences by a natural process and free expansion. There are many courses in the world for education. Bachelor of Education, Master of Education. If all the courses are distilled and made brief as possible, this paragraph is enough. All the courses of education ultimately can be reduced to this. So if you master this one paragraph, I'll give you B.Ed. Only this one paragraph is enough. He will seek to awaken much more than to instruct. He will aim at the growth of the faculties and the experiences by a natural process and free expansion. This word, growth of faculties, is very important. Our education normally is by books and subjects. Whereas a good teacher is very concerned with the faculties. It may be this subject or that subject or any other subject. What is important is to develop the faculty. There are four important faculties in the human being. One is the faculty of sensation, senses. Development of sense faculty is the development of the powers which are inherent first in senses, power of observation, of seeing accurately, of enjoying accurately, correctly, experience of hearing. When you hear music and when you are able to appreciate different tunes of music, different notes of music, different pitches of music, then you have cultivated the faculty of hearing. And when you hear music, if you can hear the inaudible sounds, the sounds which are audible, of course, are heard, but between the sounds there are inaudible sounds. And if you can hear the inaudible sounds, it is just as in the picture, what is painted is of course good, but what is not painted, and you can observe what is not painted, that is a deeper sight, deeper eye of the artist. So first faculty to be developed is a sense. The second faculty is the faculty of the mind. Mind is also sense, but it's a coordinating sense. It is a sense which coordinates all the other senses. When you can coordinate sound and sight, as you, when you see the huge cinema, the medium of cinema gives you sound and sight together. It is like a mind. Our mind is an automatic cinematographic faculty. It coordinates varieties of experiences. Of course, cinema is not a complete coordinating faculty because you can't taste. When you see somebody eating, you do not taste what he is tasting. You cannot experience a sensation of touch as yet in cinema. But the mind can do all this together. So the faculty of the mind is very important. The coordinating activity. How much you can coordinate. The third faculty is the faculty of imagination. Without experience or based on experience, you can make image in the mind. That is imagination, capacity to make image. As accurate an image as possible. That takes you to the experience of metaphors, similes, analogies, and try to image an experience or expand the experience into an image. There is a third faculty. The fourth faculty is the faculty of reason. The capacity of deduction, of induction, faculty of ratiocination, faculty of connecting cause and effect, faculty of connecting cause and effect. When there is a long chain of connections, and when you can successfully make the full chain, that is the process of ratiocination. A is the cause of B, B is the cause of C, C is the cause of D, D is the cause of E, E is the cause of F, of G. Therefore, A is the cause of G, is the process of ratiocination. So, faculty of reason is a faculty by which you deduce, you induce deduction, induction. Deduction is where from a larger proposition you derive a smaller proposition. That is called deduction. From all, you derive something that is applicable to one or to some. That is deduction. Induction is the opposite process. You go from particular to universal. That is induction. From one example, you conclude in all cases, it will happen in the same way. That is called induction. Then ratiocination. When you can connect cause and effect, and when you can connect cause and effect in a long chain, and then you have implication. Induction, deduction, implication. All these are processes of inference. Inference. Inference is to start from one proposition and derive another proposition. That is a process of inference. So this inference is done by deduction, induction, implication, by ratiocination. So reason is supposed to be the instrument of inference. You are rational when you can infer correctly and objectively. That is called power of inference. It's a great faculty in the human mind to infer. It goes beyond experience. In sensation, you have experience. But in reason, you have further capacity. You go beyond experience. Because you have experienced in India, in your immediate experience, ground and water and air, etc., you can be sure that even if you go to California, there will be earth and water and so on. You have not experienced it, but you infer. Basically, there is no difference between India and California. No difference. Therefore, if it is possible to have here earth, water, fire, etc., in California also you will have. Without experience, you can say, you can infer. So, rational faculty is the faculty by which you can infer accurately, decisively. So, this is the fourth faculty. Sensation, mind, imagination, reason. And the fifth faculty is intuition, capacity of intuition. It is called knowledge by identity. But knowledge by identity, even with invisible, there's a speciality of intuition. Even what is invisible, inaudible to our senses, even that you can be identified with. That is a speciality of intuition. And of course, intuition itself has got many other faculties into which we will not go just now. It's a big science by itself. But the important point is that the good teacher has his eye on the faculties of his students. He may teach any subject, maybe history, geography, mathematics, science, whatever. But his concern is whether you are developing the faculties. In our ordinary system of education, what is tested is only whether you know this fact or that fact, whether you are informed of this or that. But very few teachers try to understand the faculty development, whether your ideas have become clear, whether your spellings are correct or not, whether you can reason properly or not, whether your observations are correct or not. You may write very briefly, not very at length, but your brief statement should convey the development of your faculties. And the good teacher's experience is with the faculties development. So, he will aim at the growth of the faculties and the experiences by a natural process and free expansion. You can see in one sentence, Sri Aurobindo has written so much. Growth of faculties and experiences by a natural process and free expansion. A good teacher is one who does not allow the students to feel burdened. He gradually grows, does not give a lot of homework, and does not load the child. He repeats several times. He does not tire of repeating, so that the child does not have the burden of memorizing too many things. You might have learnt of deduction earlier. You will forget after some time. Doesn't matter. He will repeat again and say, what is deduction? What is induction? What is implication? Again and again. So there is a natural expansion. The expansion will be natural. It will not be by hammering. Not by cramming. It will be a joyous experience. Every time there is freshness. And you grow with that freshness. He will give a method as an aid. He will give a method as an aid, as a utilizable device, not as an imperative formula or a fixed routine. Every individual needs a method, but the good teacher remembers that the method is not a fixed thing. It is not a routine to be followed. It is not something that binds you. It only helps you. And the moment you are helped, you can fling away the methods. You become more free and master. And he will be on guard. He will be on his guard against any turning of the means into limitations, against the mechanizing of process. His whole business is to awaken the divine light. A good teacher, his main business is not sensation, not imagination, not ratiocination. These are good things. They should be included. But his main interest is how much you are awakened to the presence of the divine in your being. His whole business is to awaken the divine lights and set working the divine force, of which himself is only a means and an aid, a body or a channel. Now you will see in this one paragraph, Sri Aurobindo has put down the entire process of education, the entire process of the methods of education, the entire role of the teacher, his beginning, his middle, his end. That's why I said, if you master this one paragraph, you have got a complete science and art of education. All the rest is footnotes. Now Sri Aurobindo expands upon three instruments of the teacher. Instructions, example, and influence. Since these are the three most important instruments of the teacher, the example is more powerful than the instruction. Once I told you, education is what remains after you have forgotten all that you have learned. What remains with you is the example of the teachers. You may forget everything that he has taught you, but what remains is the example of the teacher. The example is more powerful than the instruction. It is not the example of the outward acts, nor that of the personal character, which is of most importance. These have their place and their utility. But what will most stimulate aspiration in others is a central fact of the divine realization within him, governing his whole life and inner state and all his activities. This is the universal and essential element. When you say example of the teacher, it is his own inner realization and how much his realization is reflected in his life, in his activities. It is that which is of central importance. The rest belongs to individual person and circumstances. It is this dynamic realization that the sadhaka must feel and reproduce in himself according to his own nature. He need not strive after an imitation from outside, which may well be sterilizing rather than productive of right and natural fruits. You may imitate the teacher outwardly. For some time you may feel happy. Afterwards it becomes sterile. The real imitation has to be the realization of his teacher. If you can reproduce his realization, that is a real imitation. Influence is more important than example. Last time I told you the meaning of influence. Influence is the radiation of the inner contact, of the intimacy of the soul of the teacher with the soul of the student. Because that is the only thing that is intimate. Everything else is outward. The touch of the soul with the soul. There is nothing more intimate than the soul. What you are is your soul. What the teacher is his soul. His soul touching your soul, that is influence, radiation of that touch. Influence is more important than example. influence is not the outward authority of the teacher over his disciples. It is not a position that you occupy with your students. Very often, most of the teachers exercise their influence because he sits near his table on a platform in higher position and therefore influencing the pupils. But that is not a real influence. Influence is not the outward authority of the teacher over his disciple, but the power of his contact, of his presence, of the nearness of his soul to the soul of another, infusing into it, even though in silence. These words are so important and so beautiful, one would like to read again and again. So I'll read it. Influence is more important than example. Influence is not the outward authority of the teacher over his disciple, but the power of his contact, of his presence, of the nearness of his soul to the soul of another, infusing into it, even though in silence, that which he himself is and possesses. This is the supreme sign of the master. For the greatest master is much less a teacher than a present, pouring the divine consciousness and its constituting light and power and purity and bliss into all who are receptive around him. And it shall also be a sign of the teacher of the integral yoga that he does not arrogate to himself guruhood in a humanly vain and self-exalting spirit. The unripe men, when they want to be teachers or ambition of a teacher, they want to have authority of a teacher, they want to exercise influence upon people by arrogating themselves to themselves guruhood. I am guru, you are my disciple, you must follow me. Impose himself upon the pupil. That is a sign that he is not a teacher. It shall also be a sign of the teacher of the integral yoga that he does not arrogate to himself guruhood in a humanly vain and self-exalting spirit. He is extremely humble. His work, if he has won, is a trust from above. He himself a channel, a vessel, or a representative. He is a man helping his brothers, a child leading children, a light kindling other lights, an awakened soul awakening souls, at highest a power of presence of the divine, calling to him other powers of the divine. In every experience he finds his pupil is a living God. So he deals with every pupil as God. And if he is himself a God, he is calling all others who are also God. This is the highest condition of a good teacher. He doesn't deal with the child as if he is a child, ignorant. There is only outward experience of the child. But inwardly, he is himself a living God. And therefore, he deals with everyone as if he is God himself. So, we have come to the culmination of the experience of a good teacher. Now, what remains is very little. We have done three great aids. Shastra, Utsaha and the Guru. Now we shall come to Kara. The sadhaka who has all these aids is sure of his goal. Even a fall will be for him only a means of rising, and death a passage towards fulfillment. For once on his path, birth and death become only processes in the development of his being and the stages of his journey. Time is the remaining aid needed for the effectivity of this process. Time presents itself to human effort as an enemy or a friend, as a resistance, a medium, or an instrument. But always it is really instrument of the soul. Every dramatist knows, if you're a drama writer, no drama can be a successful drama unless a dramatist knows the secret of time. He knows that everything has a movement. No event can occur without a preceding development within a certain time frame. It's a musician. A good musician is one who knows the time to be taken to organize different tunes. You cannot come to crescendo unless you have developed a certain movement of musical process. You cannot have a mango fruit immediately after planting a seed of mango into the soil. There is a time element. The whole world is nothing but a series of processes and produce in which time is the ripener. Without time, nothing ripens. And therefore, all wise people are very patient because they all know the value of time. It doesn't say, I have taken 1 year and yet nothing has happened. Every process has its own rhythm. And you may have all the aids, but if you do not honor time, then you may feel great frustration, disappointment, and it weakens our processes. Therefore, we must know what is time and how time has been utilized. That is the reason why everyone has to be careful about making a timetable. Every student should make a good timetable. It's a very good art. At what time, what you have natural tendency to do, accordingly organize your timetable. So, what you need to do is, as Shatrindo says, to the human effort, which is impatient, ignorant, or when it becomes wise, the more human being becomes wise, he treats time as instrument. He utilizes the time as an instrument. But otherwise, the more egoistic I am, the more I feel time to be my enemy. There's one very nice sentence in the drama called Hamlet of Shakespeare, time is out of joints. And it says time is out of joints. Whenever he goes to do something, he is always late. It's too late. He does not happen to do something at the right moment. And this is our experience constantly. When we are very egoistic, you will find time is out of joints. When you need something exactly at that moment, that thing is not found. It may be all the time with you, all the time. Exactly at the moment when you need it, it's not there. That means you have not organized your time properly. Time is found to be an enemy. Now Sri Aurobindo explains what is time. Time is a field of circumstances and forces. Meeting and working out a resultant progression whose course it may. In two lines, he has given the best definition of time. There are many definitions of time. For example, time is a succession of moments. I told you this definition earlier. Time is succession of moments. Now, Sri Aurobindo, however, gives a more comprehensive definition of time. Time is a field. You can see a field is not successive. Field is holistic. Every field is holistic. Therefore, time here is not a linear time. The definition of time that Sri Aurobindo gives here is, time is not something linear, successive, step by step moving forward. Time is a field of circumstances and forces. Not only circumstances, but also forces. Unless circumstances and forces working within circumstances meet, crisscross, they are assembled, there is no real process of time. Time measures, of course, a process. But that process is a resultant of circumstances, forces, which meet each other, cross each other, and then produce a sequence. As a result of which, that which is in the process becomes a product. There is a result which comes out. Time is a field of circumstances and forces meeting and working out a resultant progression whose course it measures. I think this is the one definition you should memorize. It's a beautiful definition, a very comprehensive definition of time. Time is a field of circumstances and forces meeting and working out a resultant progression whose course it measures. If you become a story writer, if you become a dramatist, you have to understand the secret process of time. In fact, Aristotle, who wrote a book on drama, he said a good drama is one which has unity of space and time. Unity of space and time, not only succession. Unity of space and time. A good dramatist knows at what point of time movement his drama should start. All great stories, all great dramas, you measure their starting point. At what point of time the drama starts. So that what has happened is not described, is not necessarily described. It will come in the very course of an unfoldment. If you read Hamlet, for example, Hamlet is one of the greatest dramas from a dramatic point of view. If you study Hamlet as a drama, the very first scene, you should read especially Hamlet, the first scene of Hamlet, how it starts. It is dark night. Not a mouse, not a rat stirring. Complete hush. All suspense of the moment, of the time is pregnant. What has happened in the past is filled in that moment. What is to happen in the future is also held in that moment. It's very pregnant moment. And Shakespeare begins his dawn of the drama and inquires, because all have heard that a ghost appears in the castle and they wanted to see whether today, tonight, the ghost will appear or not. And the whole story hangs on the ghost and the appearance of the ghost and what the ghost communicates. The whole drama, the whole tragedy is based upon that time, that moment. It is the meeting of forces. It is a circumstance. And the meeting of forces in which a resultant product is worked out. A resultant progression is worked out. Now this is a very brief description of time, but a very comprehensive. Now Sri Aurobindo says, to the ego, it is a tyrant or a resistance. To the divine, an instrument. Why is time a tyrant or a resistance? Because the ego does not respect circumstances. Ego does not respect the meeting of forces. Ego is interested only in itself. What it wants, its own assertions, its own affirmation, and its immediate need of realization of what it wants, is the mark of the ego. Unaware of the circumstances, unaware of the forces which are at work. As Sri Aurobindo says, the ego considers the whole world moving around itself. As if everything is created for itself. It looks upon the world as its own instrument. Not that it is itself instrument of all. To it, all is insignificant. Itself is the most significant thing. This is the limitation of the egoistic consciousness. And therefore, when it meets the circumstances, it meets the forces which are being worked out, it finds resistance. Because circumstances do not respect the ego. The forces which are around, they don't respect the ego. They go all on their own way, for themselves. To the ego, it is a tyrant or a resistance. To the divine, an instrument. The divine has a complete good account of everything. Of the ego and the all. The relationship between this little finite and the all. Therefore, to the divine, everything is an instrument. Therefore, while our effort is personal, time appears as a resistance. For it presents to us all the obstruction of the forces that conflict with our own. When the divine working and the personal are combined in our consciousness, it appears as a medium and condition. When the two become one, it appears as a servant and instrument. When the divine will and my will become identical, then time is only an instrument, a servant. Whatever time you need for the accomplishment of the work, exactly that much time you will get in your work. You will find during that time, everything is smooth. Nothing uninvited comes into the picture. Nothing unexpected comes into the picture. Everything that happens is just on the spot. I had seen with the mother very often, if she was in need of a fountain pen, it just came to her as a gift from somebody, exactly at the right moment. If she wanted information from somebody, he found that that person where the information was just on the door, at the gate, and came exactly at the right moment and gave the right information. When you are the master of time, you find exactly this condition. Whenever you need X, X is available. If you think that X is not needed now, X will not be available at that time. Whatever you need, it happens exactly at the right time. In fact, everything happens at the right time, if you know the divine's way of doing things. But because of our egoistic veiling, egoistic eagerness, egoistic tyranny, we find time is out of joints. Basically, time is never out of joints. Everything is measured out. Everything happens at the right moment. When I need you, you are with me. When you need me, I am with you. This is the tune and the harmony and the rhythm of life. If you get out of the egoistic preoccupation, everything falls as an instrument. Therefore, now Sri Aurobindo gives the greatest advice, the greatest formula of dealing with time. How to deal with time. The ideal attitude of the sadhaka towards time is to have an endless patience as if he had all eternity for his fulfillment, and yet to develop the energy that shall realize now and with an ever-increasing mastery and pressure of rapidity, till it reaches the miraculous instantaneousness of the supreme divine transformation. Let us read again. You shall read 5 times, because it is the most important sentence in this chapter. The ideal attitude of the sadhaka towards time is to have an endless patience as if he had all eternity for his fulfillment. Therefore, never to be in haste. No hurry. Endless patience. That is the first attitude. Don't demand that now I must realize God today. It's an ignorant demand. Egoistic demand, as if you are important rather than God being important. You should have endless patience, as if He had all eternity for his fulfillment. So imagine the kind of patience that one must have. Many people who turn to the path of yoga egoistically, they demand so much from the divine, they become frustrated easily, and they have a fall in their yoga. They destroy their own efforts by becoming too impatient. But that is not enough. It is only half sentence, we must remember. It's not the full sentence. While being very patient, you have something to do here and now. Don't say, oh, there is a lot of time, yet everything will happen. This is an attitude of patience which is good. But at the same time, couple it with another, which you have to do now. What do you do now? You develop now the energy. Whatever faculties you have, whatever faculties you can develop now, without postponement, you develop them now. Develop the energy. What kind of energy? Such an energy that shall realize now, and with an ever increasing mastery and pressure of rapidity, till it reaches the miraculous instantaneousness of the supreme divine transformation. You should develop your energy now, and more and more, and more and more, as rapidly as possible, so that a day may come, not now, a day may come, when what is needed to be done can be done immediately, instantaneously. You ask, it is given in the spot. Complete transformation you want, on the spot it can happen. Now, on immediately. So you combine two attitudes. Mother once said to me, a good definition of time, how to handle it. Do, first of all, she said, have no ambition. N'ambition jamais. Have no ambition. Because this ambition always breaks you down. Have no ambition. You have a goal. But have no ambition. Then, whatever you can do, without pretension, whatever you can do, be very humble, whatever you can do, whatever you want to do, whatever you have to do, do it as perfectly and as quickly as possible. As perfectly and as quickly as possible. Now you combine both the things, quickness and perfection. You combine them together, you get the exactly right rhythm of time movement. Do as perfectly as you can and do as quickly as you can. When these two will be combined together, this formula of Sri Aurobindo will be fulfilled.